This episode is presented without commercial interruptions, in exchange for which I implore you, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com, click the Amazon banner on the side of the page, and bookmark that. Make that your new home for Amazon, where you do all of whatever Amazon shopping you would do anyway. Anything you've purchased from that page, or any of the other Amazon click-throughs on our page, will send a small kickback to us at no additional cost for you. So if you enjoy the Partially Examined Life, but don't feel you can make a contribution, or even if you are already a contributor, if you can make this an ongoing habit, this would really help us out. Thank you so much for your support. Now on with the show. Hey, this is the Partially Examined Life. This is part two of episode 124 on Epictetus, Stoicism. Last time, we were in the middle of talking about what it is to have the will be conformable to nature. So this whole conformable to nature business, you know, we said it might have something to do with fate. It probably has something to do with acting in tune with your own personal abilities. But of course, teleology for Aristotle, mostly it's not an individual matter. It's a species matter. And I do see a lot of places in here. For instance, number 39, the body is to everyone the measure of the possessions proper for it, just as the foot is of the shoe. If therefore you stop at this, you will keep the measure. But if you move beyond it, you must necessarily be carried forward as down a cliff. As in the case of a shoe, if you go beyond its fitness to the foot, it comes first to be gilded, then purple, then studded with jewels. For to that which one exceeds a due measure, there is no bound.
Purple and studded with jewels. So tone down your shoes, prince, is what we're saying?
No, it's a matter of keeping everything functional, right? Don't go beyond the bounds. The functional, that's what teleology is all about. So it's not only just your human nature. It seems unlikely that a Spartacus, a great disruptor of the social order, that's part of human nature.
Yeah, it's interesting that he looks at, if we're going to take the Spartacus example, he might look at slave upward mobility as almost like an embarrassment of riches, of saying, with the shoe example, like, well, don't go beyond just functionality and go crazy and need more and more things for having cool shoes. He could look at life the same sort of way, but
the institution of slavery, is that what you're saying? That even just having slaves or having a lot of slaves, like, that seems excessive.
Yeah. I mean more like the guy trying to escape slavery. Like, he's saying, this is your lot in life and just go as far as you need to be comfortable. Although I don't think that works. So for him saying, you trying to escape, that's you overstepping your bounds and not being at will with nature.
I guess I'm inclined to reword it a little bit. Maybe I'm just basically agreeing with Wes's interpretation that he put forward, that this is less dogmatic and more about being cognizant and reflective about how your desires are affecting your own freedom. And so it would be less about the social mores, you know, shut up and just do what you're told to do. I think it's true that there's this open question about what you do about changing your position. Mark, you said that you thought that, well, Spartacus could not possibly be a Stoic properly because these features of being in accord with nature are teleological and those are species driven. And it seems unlikely that it's natural for a human being to be so rebellious. It seems an open question that human beings aren't naturally rebellious. I'm not sure that that's the case. And then the other part is that species seems like it's maybe going too far in the case of human beings, because there is definitely, even in teleology, a fittingness that goes across species. I mean, the constant examples are even within human beings, you know, and the fittingness of the shoe is a perfect example. In this case, it was functional, but you'd also have the same kind of fittingness, not just in terms of function, but whether it actually fits your foot, and whether your foot's a size 5 or size 12, or if you are a huge person, you need to eat more than a little tiny person does, that kind of thing.
So we had a similar conversation with the Peronian skepticism episode. Because there's the same sort of objective with skepticism where you achieve tranquility. And there's a famous conversation around that. You know, how can skeptics lead daily life and never get anything done? And the skeptics argued, yes, you can have habits and opinions. It's just that you have a sort of reflective detachment from them. And it's sort of reminiscent of a sort of Nietzschean ironic distance from one's life. And I think that actually the same conversation happened with Stoicism. We should mention that just historically, this was a hot issue. And Stoics defended the idea that you could live your life and do things and have opinions and things like that, and yet still be a Stoic. But from this particular text, it seems somewhat contradictory to me. It's unclear from this text, I think, how that would work exactly.
There is something pointing in that direction, though, Wes, in the second to last chapter, chapter 52, which incidentally was my favorite. You know, he invokes the philosopher a number of times, but this is one place where he sort of criticizes the breadth of different kinds of attitudes in philosophy. He says, "The first and most important field of philosophy is the application of principles such as do not lie. Next come the proofs, such as why we should not lie. The third field supports and articulates the proofs by asking, for example, how does this prove it? What exactly is a proof? What is logical inference? What is contradiction? What is truth? What is falsehood? Thus, the third field is necessary because of the second, and the second because of the first. The most important, though, the one that should occupy most of our time, is the first. But we do just the opposite. We are preoccupied with the third field and give that all our attention, passing the first altogether. The result is that we lie, but we have no difficulty proving why we shouldn't." That's like a big bitch slap to analytical philosophy, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I agree with Dylan that the last section of any work of philosophy is my favorite.
Well, the second to last.
The second to last. The penultimate. Penultimate. This notion of being accord with nature, one of the things that is not so much about the natural order of, say, the natural social order, but the idea that in nature there are essentially appearances without judgment. So I think part of what's in that formulation is that things happen in nature and they don't have a value or a judgment associated with them. There are storms, there are mudslides, there's good harvest, animals get along or they eat each other or whatever. And I thought that part of what it meant to be in accord with nature was to understand how we, in essence, put an overlay of judgment on top of the things that happen in a way that, for example, animals don't. And that part of being in accord with nature is also just letting things be what they are and just focusing on our own reaction.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think this leads us into maybe talk about the ruling principle. Before I get to that, just reaffirming your point, Seth, section 41, he advocates turning your whole attention toward your faculty of judgment instead of on externals. That's the thing over which we have power and so on and so forth. And then I thought that's related, although I'm not clear how, to this mention of ruling principle, which in the ancient Greek is hegemonikon, as in hegemony. But in section 29, at the very end, you must be one person, either good or bad. You must either work on your ruling principle or work on externals, as in fame and fortune, things like that. Practice the art either of what is inside or of what is outside. That is, play the role either of a philosopher or a non-philosopher. And then there's another mention of the ruling principle at 38. Pay attention the same way so as not to harm your ruling principle, in the same way that you would avoid stepping on nails to hurt your feet. Be on guard about this in every action. This idea that there's this ruling principle, it's unclear to me except in the footnote where in my edition, he gives the ancient Greek again, hegemonikon, and it's the idea, so he says, it's the complicated psychological theory adopted by the Stoics, that central part of the soul that can understand what is good and decide to act on that understanding. This ruling principle has something to do with the faculty of judgment. But again, this is still a little opaque to me in how it fits into.
Seems like the only thing you're allowed to hate is yourself. You're not allowed to have any opinions on anything except how you're reacting to it. So it's just like, I wish I would feel better about this, or I wish I wouldn't take this so hard. It's really almost like a self-loathing kind of happening.
Where do you get the self-loathing part? And why is it about hating yourself?
Because the whole time he's saying, there's all, I forget what passages, but there's some parts that say, like, don't be averse to anything but that which would make you not see the choices clearly of what's in your control or not. And there was another part that said, be watchful of yourself as your own enemy to your stoicism, something like that. It seems like the only thing he's okay with you saying, I don't like, is yourself in that you might be getting in your own way, which to me says, I'm always screwing this up. It's almost like a finger pointing back at you.
I don't get the part where it's about screwing up. I mean, being attentive to how things are working is, and regulating that is not the same thing as loathing it.
No, I'm saying loathing yourself for not living up to the standard that he is setting.
Well, so section five is one of those where he talks about the different levels of how awesome a Stoic sage you are. When we are hindered or disturbed or grieved, let us never attribute it to others but to ourselves, that is, to our own principles. And here we go. An uninstructed person will lay the fault of his own bad conditions upon others. Someone just starting instruction will lay the fault on himself. Someone who's perfectly instructed will place blame neither on others nor on himself. So it's the self-loathing, the being hard on yourself. Let's not say self-loathing. That implies okay. Something terminal and irredeemable. But the being hard on yourself is a stage in the instruction that when you really get it, then, and I don't know whether that's just because you've mastered yourself and so you're not going to place blame on yourself, or because in trying to apply this ourselves, it would be because you forgive yourself. It's not just that the things that are outside you are not under your control, but that even some of the things inside you are not under your control. And so if something bad happens and you react bad to it, then you recognize the truth. The truth is that it's your own reaction that is causing any suffering. But do you blame yourself for then suffering? Well, maybe you don't. You just say that's how it is.
Yeah, I was with you until you said there are some things inside yourself that are not under your control. I feel like that's actually one of the...
Well, like being in pain.
But that's body, and body's not under your control.
Well, it's a feeling, but you have feelings. So when he gives that list in the beginning, he talks about impulses, desires, aversions. Opinions, impulses, desires, aversions. Those are the interior things that are up to us. But it seems like there's a whole realm of interior things beyond those things, which are not up to us. So,
but that's an anachronism. Taking the Cartesian, everything that I feel is part of my inner life, including the sensations I have of things and of my own pains. And those are all mental. Whereas the only thing that's physical are actually body, reputation, command, etc. That seems kind of foreign to him. That I agree with Seth.
I don't think so. I think, in fact, Descartes picked up right where these traditions left off. It was he's heavily influenced, for instance, by ancient skepticism, which has a very clear idea of what's interior. There's no evidence in here that pain and pleasure are not interior things. And again, he's only listing opinions, impulses, desires, aversions. Certainly there's more to inner life than that.
So. Okay. Well, two things. One is what I gathered from the quote that Mark read, and then what he was saying was, if somebody says something bad about me and I get upset, if I was a non-philosopher, or in our translation, vulgar, I would blame it on the other person. If I'm beginning my instruction or I'm somehow not a perfect Stoic, I would say, I blame it on myself. I shouldn't be. I'd get upset with myself in the sense of I shouldn't get upset at that. I shouldn't let that person affect me that way. And then if you reach the point of you're a full-fledged Stoic philosopher, then it feels like you might say, well, I recognize that I'm having this feeling of being upset, but I don't blame him or myself.
Yeah. So the reason why I think this is important is, again, going back to this idea, that these are opinions, impulses, desires, aversions. What he's really talking about are judgments. And that's why I thought that's section 41 on the paying attention to the faculty of judgment is important. And that does sort of support the reading that there might be passing emotions over which you obviously have no control. But again, it's the reflective judgment about that emotion that's important. It's conceivable that you would train yourself or habituate yourself such that your emotions are modified. But I think the idea that we have this direct control over what emotions we feel, it seems implausible. And to get a consistent reading out of this, we have to say, well, what he's really thinking we have control of are our judgments.
And having control over your judgments is actually a matter of seeing the truth, that if you get offended by something, then you're being taken away with the appearance. The appearance is that this person saying something about me is hurting me.
Exactly.
But the truth of the fact is it's not hurting me. The only thing that could hurt me is if I fail myself, is if I don't have the fortitude or, you know, whatever. Those are the only things that could even potentially hurt me, because those are the only things that belong to me. So internalizing that truth is the goal.
And so I guess we're still brought back with this issue of hurting is hurting, getting hurt and getting affected externally is what the mode of action and the activity of something akin to self-preservation would be. And for instance, things like, you know, how is ambition balanced with this kind of attitude of impassivity?
Yeah. If my goal is to become a great politician, for instance, or let's say a writer, or even what about the desire to become a philosopher? I mean, are all those paths cut off to us? Or is it a matter of saying, it's not that I'm attached to these things and that if I don't get them, woe is me. It's that these things are fitting. It's in accord with my nature to take steps in those directions. And again, if fate dictates otherwise, then I embrace that as well. We'd have to work on that to get a consistent statement that reconciles a real world existence with the Stoic way of life.
Yeah, I think this is one of those things that if we spent some time, quality time in the discourses, we get more meat on the bones of this part of it. Because, you know, he has sections on indifference and on ambition.
Just to clarify, the discourses is a different work, also written by the same author, taking things down in shorthand. But it's kind of the philosopher Epictetus in action with his students. These are the actual lecture notes, whereas the handbook here, this is the distillation. This is the end product that you can fit in your pocket.
Yes, that's right. And so in the discourses, there are three books conventionally of them. And you'll have in certain points, there's a lot of things that amount to quotes, Epictetus manifesting, you know, someone, I say this or you say that. And you have a little bit of that in the handbook. But then you have also parts where Epictetus says blah, 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 blah. So,
and is he a jackass? Is he a Zen master in any of it where he pulls a fast one on his students, or is it all straightforward teaching?
Is there washing on and washing off?
Did you guys get the translation where he uses the word blockhead?
No.
He's like, hey, don't do this. You'll be a blockhead. I'm like, thanks, Three Stooges? Like, what is, what is?
That's probably a very literal translation from the Greek, I'm sure.
If thou wants what thou cannot have, thou is a meathead.
You're a Stoic, Charlie Brown.
When the football is taken away from you, do not grieve. But acknowledge that this will happen.
Do not say, Lucy is kind of a jerk.
The football has been returned.
It was obviously never his to begin with. Come on.
That's deep. Yeah, I mean, it was. I think it was Lucy's football anyway. She was just a sadist. It wasn't like she was using his football against him. That'd be like, that's some.
Well, and she never plays with the football on her own. She just only has it there.
She bought a football just to torture him. That's fucked up. That's like some True Detective shit.
Yeah, she's a dark character. There's no doubt about it.
Yes.
I want to call out this quote from section one again, just to see what we think of it now that we've talked more about it. But if you suppose that only to be your own, which is your own, and what belongs to others, such as it really is, then no one will ever compel you or restrain you. Further, you will find fault with no one or accuse no one. You will do nothing against your will. No one will hurt you. You will have no enemies, and you will not be harmed. Like, that is pretty over-the-top language.
The only thing that you will is to have good judgments, and the only thing that can harm you is not having good judgments.
Yep. Yeah.
But, like, you will have no enemies? You will see no one as an enemy, right? Because you're not taking things personally, because you're not the kind of person who... Exactly. But can't somebody really hate you? Can't you be their enemy still?
Well, I don't think he's... I don't think he's not saying that.
This just goes back to the interpretation thing. Like, is someone your enemy if you view them as not your enemy? And what's out of your control now is how they view, because they could go, he's my enemy, I am his enemy, but you might not agree, which then makes the one in your control... that he's not your enemy. It's absurd, yeah. But that's, I think, what he's saying.
Well, certainly he's saying someone can persecute you and hate you and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But you're not in that state of mind where you're disturbed and hating the other person and so on and so forth. You see them as a natural occurrence. They're just a... There's an irony to that being a natural occurrence because it's those people that, you know, are in a state of mind where they're not in acting in accordance with nature, right? And yet they are natural occurrences. So their interior unnaturalness is, from an exterior point of view, completely natural.
There's a section 45 in this translation. It says, does anyone drink a great quantity of wine? Don't say that he does ill, but that he drinks a great quantity. For unless you perfectly understand the principle from which anyone acts, how shall you know if he acts ill? Thus you will not run the hazard of assenting any appearances, but such as you fully comprehend. And I think this goes back to the being in accord with nature, where if you use a descriptive apparatus that treats people the same way you would say, oh, that tree is growing out of a hillside, or that falcon caught that mouse, in the same way you're describing other people's and not putting a judgment on it that this person's doing something right or doing something wrong, because you don't know what are the internal principles according to which they need to operate in order to have their eudaimonia.
That's really interesting. I miss that.
Section 25 too kind of supports that, where he says, if somebody gets something that you want, don't be jealous. Instead, if that something you want is good, then be happy that somebody got something that's good, and just be happy that you avoid things that are bad, even if it's not related to possession. But anyway.
And you can't tell if it's actually good or bad for them.
You don't know.
From the external, because it's yeah.
Yeah. This notion of accord with nature, but also the discussion that we've been having about this kind of being clearly from a slave's perspective, it made me think of Nietzsche and the idea of building a morality out of a certain ressentiment. And so I did a quick little search to see if Nietzsche had anything to say about the Stoics, and he does.
Life haters.
What he says is that Stoicism is a fraud of words. Because he says, you desire to live according to nature. What a fraud of words. Imagine to yourselves a being like nature, boundlessly extravagant, boundlessly indifferent, without purpose or consideration, without pity or justice. Imagine to yourselves indifference as a power. How could you live in accordance with such indifference? To live, is not that just endeavoring to be otherwise than this nature? So he's basically saying, you made a principle out of something that you must do and you must be, and then you turn around and you try to dictate terms to nature.
Well, it sounds like living requires the struggle, you know, against nature.
He calls Stoicism self-tyranny.
So on one reading of this, of course, yeah, it could be.
Well, yeah, so Nietzsche would come down on the polar opposite, right, of reveling in ecstasy and maximizing that ecstasy.
And the struggle. So it's, you know, the Stoic wants to withdraw from the battlefield in a sense.
Yes. The Stoic soldier would be going through in great efficiency and grim duty and saving people and killing in one shot, whereas the Nietzschean warrior would be, I don't know, more Achillean and reveling and being a upfront badass.
Yeah.
Enjoying it the whole time.
And certainly more capable of pride than...
Yes, being prideful
and
about it.
Yeah, and not worrying about that. Pride seems something cut off to the Stoic.
Based on various things that we know about Nietzsche from having read a bunch of his stuff, I think we could give a lot of ways in which you could interpret Nietzsche's ethical recommendations as acting in accord with nature in some way. But just looking at the particular quote that Seth read, that just seems clearly a Schopenhauerian view of nature as this chaotic force, and nobody could actually act like that, which it seems a little beside the point. You know, the Stoic is not saying, Epictetus is not coming with Schopenhauer's version of nature and saying, oh, that's what we have to ask. No, he just has a different, more Aristotelian take on nature.
I thought it was interesting, but I certainly found plenty of people who were rejoinders to the Nietzsche criticism.
Yeah, Schopenhauer himself, I think he thinks that the Stoic sages, just like the Buddhist sages, are right on target. That this is how to deal with a crazy-ass chaotic nature, is to say, that's got nothing to do with the good as far as I'm concerned. I will be more self-contained and withdraw from that. And therefore, Nietzsche would respond and say, oh, you people are all despisers of life. You're not buying into the struggle. The struggle, what nature is what you have to get into. So it's just a matter of what you're calling nature. Well, can we say more about what Epictetus calls nature?
Well, he doesn't really say much. We've been sort of making guesses, right? And I focused on the determinism part of things. And Mark, you are focusing on the more teleological conception.
So back to that quote that I read in number one, you know, if you are the Stoic sage, you will not be harmed. No one will hurt you. Well, we understand what that means because I'm the Stoic sage and I'm saying the only thing that could hurt me is if you somehow got into my free will, and you can't do that. So ha. But if you combine this with the idea of teleology, you know, the human teleology is to grow in a certain way. It has things more to do with than just the mind and the mind ruling over the body. It has to do with the fitness of the body and the fitness of the body and the mind. So it seems very hard to say that your whole body could be wrecked. Let's say you even get brain damage. So your mental faculties are even getting messed with. You're in a lot of pain, and that somehow doesn't harm you.
That's a hard case, the mental faculties, because the faculty of judgment is the one thing we're supposed to have control over. And if that's violated.
So let's just separate out the two cases. Even if your physical body is being really messed up, you're in enough pain. And we've said that pain is basically something associated with the body. Maybe you can't suppress pain in the same way you could suppress desire. Then doesn't that interfere? Doesn't that harm you? You can't just say, my good has to do with my mind, and my mind is ruling over the faculties of the body, including pain. And so I'm not really harmed, even though ouch, ouch, ouch. Like, no, that is just wordplay.
I think you may be right, Mark, that there may be a kind of idealistic notion about being able to be successful at this. But I also wonder if the case that you give example to, that there just wouldn't be an acknowledgement that, look, that would be really, really hard. There are a number of cases where it's pointed out that being successful at this way of being is very hard to do. It requires a lot of work. It requires training. And so in the case that you just gave, it seems to me you would say, well, even as a Stoic sage, you may find it very challenging to be successful at being indifferent in a way that was adequate to the task, and it might hurt you.
Can't you say that it's hurting you, but you're indifferent? Like, to keep the idea that I'm being harmed by, if you look at my teleology as a human being and even my personal growth, my fitness as an individual, I was born to be a shoemaker, but now I've lost both my hands and I can't be a shoemaker, that there's still something that there's being harmed about that, but you're coping with the harm. Like, I would be more comfortable with that than just this bald saying, oh, you're not even harmed if you're coping with it.
Well, I guess it depends on the interpretation of the word harm there, because the way you interpreted it now seemed to me a perfectly reasonable interpretation of the word harm, where you've abstracted it from physical bleeding and cutting off your legs and that kind of thing, and you've interpreted harm as harm to your soul, right? And so you could be indifferent and therefore not have your soul harmed, even though you were harmed in a different way.
That does seem to be where Epictetus has to come down, yes. I don't know if that's plausible. I don't. Well, and then what about the case with your mental faculties are damaged? This always seems to be a problem. You know, they just weren't aware of people. Now you have frontal lobe damage and you can't make decisions the way you used to, and you're incontinent. And so, you know, clearly things outside of your control can affect things that are inside of your control. Is that just, we just need to forget about that modern.
Yeah. I mean, chapter 9, sickness is a problem for the body, not the mind, unless the mind decides that it is a problem. Lameness, too, is the body's problem, not the mind's. Say this to yourself, whatever the circumstance, and you will find without fail that the problem pertains to something else, not to you. So that first line, sickness is a problem for the body, not the mind, seems to not even admit of the notion that there'd be something like mental illness.
Yeah, which of course is not something dependent on the advent of brain science to know that people act crazy. Like, it's right there in freaking Sophocles. Yeah.
I think we have to start with the assumption that we have someone who is has a faculty of judgment intact. I think it's consistent with the idea that, yeah, there are people whose judgment isn't intact, and then they're unlucky.
Maybe they're not people anymore. Maybe they're like dead people.
Zombies?
Well, I mean, wouldn't you say that they can't be philosophers?
Among other things.
I guess. If you have brain damage, it seems hard to be a philosopher, right?
So. But you could be a zombie.
Could you be a zombie philosopher?
I am sick of the American Philosophical Association being prejudiced against people with severe brain damage. They should allow more people on faculties.
Could you be a Stoic savant?
Like you're Rain Man, but just really good at dealing with your feelings?
Exactly. You're like statistic, where you're... where you just have a condition that makes you absolutely immune to the external things and only attend to your own internal things under your own control.
You can't help Tom Cruise count cards, but you can help him be a better person.
Wasn't that his real purpose in that movie anyway?
It was. He did turn out to be a Stoic savant.
Well, and it does seem like that, since we're talking about mental illness and brain impairments, that being a Stoic sage would require a brain impairment of a certain kind, of disconnecting your feelings to...
Yeah. You would have to literally be a psychopath.
Really?
I believe so. In essence, what he's saying, it sounds to me, is that you have to completely let go of any empathy for beings outside of yourself. because otherwise then you would have desires and aversions associated with them.
Yeah. That does seem to follow.
Give us a quote, Dylan. I know you don't buy it.
I end up leaning more towards you need to be aware of the kinds of connections that you choose to have. So I think that probably in the end you're right that the highest level of Stoic sage would be indifferent in such a way as to have sacrificed things that we consider to be important to being a human being fully, to flourishing in that way, which is having, allowing for deep connections with other human beings and having empathy for them and having that be a cause of our own actions. I tend to take it a little bit less to that end and focus more on the choosing your battles, choosing as much as possible your desires, and in fact, maximizing freedom as being the main goal. And so part of maximizing freedom would be understanding that, well, some things are going to be constraining to you. In fact, there are sections where it feels like maximizing freedom means doing the things that you do as well and fully as possible and as uninhibited as possible. But that is more like a fittingness argument. It's not like there aren't constraints. There isn't determinism. It's just that it's all working very, very well of a piece. But if you look at it, there are certainly things are lining up with one another.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think the thing that seems fundamentally flawed to me about this, there's two aspects. One is this sounds like a coping strategy. It's a way to deal with trauma or a way to deal with challenges in your life in such a way that you won't be overwhelmed with anxiety or fear or depression or all that. In that sense, it's a psychological strategy, which I don't necessarily see needs to be taken to the extreme of being a philosophical system and a way to live your entire life. I could see it as being tactically deployed at certain times to help you deal with stuff. The second thing is, I think it's calling for a denial of things that are fundamentally human. To say that you should just not feel certain ways about certain types of activities is to just deny what the foundation that Smith and Hume talk about in moral sentiments of we have empathy towards other people, and that's the foundation for being a moral person. Here, you read this, and it feels like he's saying empathy is a sure path to disappointment and frustrated desire. And so you need to overcome that and essentially only focus on things inside yourself where empathy is not a factor. I used to love Stoicism when I was much younger and I fetishized reason, right, and truth. I was much more attracted to this doctrine. But as I read it now, I'm sort of pained. Let me give you an example. So this is section 16. When you see anyone weeping in grief because his son has gone abroad or is dead, or because he has suffered in his affairs, be careful that the appearance may not misdirect you. Instead, distinguish within your own mind and be prepared to say, it's not the accident that distresses this person because it doesn't distress another person. It is the judgment which he makes about it. As far as words go, however, don't reduce yourself to his level and certainly do not moan with him. Do not moan inwardly either. That's a prescription for just being completely disconnected from other human beings.
Wait just a second. I mean, this is what you read is completely different in my translation. I mean,
yay,
I mean,
okay.
Such as to be
back to the Greek.
Such as to be exactly the opposite.
Oh, exciting. Come on, read it.
So chapter 16, he says, whenever you see someone in tears, distraught because they are parted from a child or have met with some material loss, be careful lest the impression move you to believe that their circumstances are truly bad. Have ready the reflection that they are not upset by what happened because other people are not upset by the same things happening to them, but by their own view of the matter. Nevertheless, you should not disdain to sympathize with them, at least with comforting words, or even to the extent of sharing outwardly in their grief, but do not commiserate with your whole heart and soul.
Wow. Yeah, I have something similar. Do not hesitate, however, to sympathize with them verbally.
Yes.
And even to moan with him if the occasion arises. But be careful not to moan inwardly.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
So that's exactly the opposite of what you just read.
How could this be so different? Here I'm giving Epictetus the what for over a bad translation. I apologize posthumously. Hey, Alex, do you think you could raise him from the dead? Oh, no, he's too far back. He's not modern, right?
Yeah, my powers are limited. My dark magic can only reach back so far. I'm sorry.
And they have to be comedians.
Yeah, I mean, if you want me to raise Richard Pryor, I could probably try, but he'd probably run away on fire before I could get him.
It would be post-stroke Richard Pryor, so he couldn't.
Yeah, so he wouldn't be. I mean, he still might be funny if you could understand, but it wouldn't be stage worthy at that point. I don't know how much help he would be. Probably want to be with his family and stuff, too. I don't know.
By the way, number 50, whatever moral rules you've deliberately proposed to yourself, abide by them as they were laws, and as if you would be guilty of impiety by violating any of them. Which, that's another thing that I read as, to deal with people effectively, you have to be flexible. You have to actually engage with them. And if you say that sort of every point of your conduct, my integrity demands that I act the same way in all circumstances, it just, it doesn't sound flexible enough to make you a good husband, for instance.
Well, is he really saying that? Is he saying he can't be flexible? I mean, he's saying, in my translation, abide by whatever task is set before you as if it were a law. So it depends on the scope of the word task.
Oh, see, that sounds like I am a husband. It is my role. I will play the fucking part.
No, but it's a task. It doesn't say role. You say, I'm going to do something. It's about willing. You know, I'm going to do something. And then you, there's no longer a question of doing it or not doing it.
The second sentence in chapter 50 for me says, pay no attention to whatever people might say. This no longer should influence you. This is a piece with a number of places where the emphasis is on, don't worry about what other people think. They're going to think you're crazy. And the whole integrity and sticking to your own freedom. Mark's probably right that if you go too far with that, then you're not going to accommodate anybody and not have any relationships with anyone. So
here's another part of 33 is another really great recipe for being a great spouse. Be for the most part silent, or speak merely what is necessary and in few words.
What a weird sitcom. What do you think, honey? Not really anything.
We may, however, enter, though sparingly, into discourse sometimes when occasion calls for it, but not on any of the common subjects of gladiators or horse races or athletic champions or feasts, the vulgar topics of conversation, but principally not of men, so as to either blame or praise or make comparisons. So don't be a gossip. That's fine. If you're able, then, by your own conversation, bring over that of your company to proper subjects. But if you happen to be taken among strangers, be silent. So clearly you're not supposed to gossip, but it's unclear to me sort of how otherwise debilitating that makes you as a, does that make you a prude, that there's no idle chatter here? Because really relating to somebody, this is why it's obviously, this is written by a man. This is not written by a woman. That, at least the way they tell us that how people relate to each other, that, you know, women are more, you know, the talky-talky, and you gotta, it doesn't even matter what you're saying so much. It's the doing the talking that matters. And that's what makes the social bonds there. And, so this guy needs to go read Women Are From Venus or whatever crap that would inform him.
It sounds like he was really nervous at parties. There's so many references to be like, when you're in a place you don't want to be, just smile and don't say too much and thank them for the onion rings. I think it's number 41 or whatever.
Well, he certainly isn't a political philosopher, right? Contrary to Aristotle, who says not only that we're rational animals, but we are political animals, and that we're fundamentally designed to interact with one another and build families and societies. He is, seems to be basically not of that opinion, or at least the way his philosophy is working, it's not one centered on building a flourishing community. The extent to which, at least in what we've read, that you would be concerned about that is that you do what you can based upon your social role at the time, but you don't really sweat it. But the idea of caring about, say, for instance, political freedoms and institutional laws and stuff like that doesn't seem to be of issue. He also doesn't seem to worry about justice at all. I mean, not even once.
Is justice not implied by fidelity and honor?
No, I don't think so. Just think about the way justice is characterized in the Republic and the notion of the question of justice and the way in which that question is articulated into getting what you deserve and giving your enemies what they deserve, or the will of the stronger, or the rule of the good. None of those kinds of things seem to even be gestured towards, at least in this little handbook. It seems to be, maybe Epictetus himself has thoughts about that, but this seems to be all about ethics, for lack of a better term, and about the way one ought to live themselves, but it doesn't seem to point in that ethics towards the way one is part of a community.
If you're not allowed to condemn the way things turn out, that you're supposed to morally just say, I'm with whatever, however things turned out, mm-hmm. it seems like justice is whatever actually happens. Like, there is no normative concept of justice.
Yeah, and if you have a concept of determinism, that makes perfect sense, which they do.
He does talk about friendship in here, but it's more as how you shouldn't let yourself be too influenced or sucked in or led to do disreputable things by your friends or mm-hmm. to help your friends, that the best you could do is to be a friend of fidelity and honor, which just means being a person of integrity.
There is a little bit of one in section 33 that made me laugh out loud. It said, avoid fraternizing with non-philosophers. If you must, though, be careful not to sink to their level, because, you know, if a companion is dirty, his friends cannot help but get a little dirty, too, no matter how clean they started out.
That could lead to dancing.
Your translation is funny, Dylan. Yes. It's very modern.
Yes, it reads awesome. I love it. It's really easy to read.
For be assured that if a person be ever so sound himself, yet if his companions be infected, he who converses with him will be infected likewise.
Who wrote this? Colonel Kurtz in Apocalypse Now? And be wary of the outside world. They want to take your throne of skulls.
I just heard Agent Smith's voice in that.
And Epictetus said, you are the illness and we are the cure.
Anything else about the practical? This is mostly number 33, the ethics, the manners that we hadn't hit already. We got talked about public spectacles. Don't go where appearances of authors are.
Yeah, what was that? Like, don't go to play. He said, don't go to play rehearsals. What the? Was that like a Greek thing? Like, hey, can you really come to my play rehearsal? I really need you to sacrifice your inner aversion to things that are out of your control and just watch and give me some notes. Can you betray your own fidelity and just help me out?
I don't think rehearse means practice. I just think it means oratory. The rehearsal of an author. In other words, the author saying stuff, reading his work aloud, or
in my translation is lectures.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
Don't too soon or too lightly attend other people's lectures. When you do go, remain serious and reserved without being disagreeable.
So do not bring flowers.
It would be funny if he had said, oh, don't go to the dress rehearsal. I know you'll get a better seats, but come on, it's not going to be as good a performance. Just pay the full price.
I just found a potentially other directed passage in here that might be worth reading, but I'm terrified of reading my version of the, since this translation is apparently awful and wrong. So Dylan, would you do me a favor and read your version or Wes's number 47?
47. When your body gets used to simple living, don't preen over it. If you're a water drinker, don't take every opportunity to announce it. If you want to train for physical austerities, do it for yourself, not for outsiders. Don't embrace marble statues, but if you happen to be very thirsty, try taking some cold water in your mouth and spitting it out, and don't tell anyone. Do you know what embracing marble statues is?
Yeah.
No.
So apparently there was, among some Stoics like Diogenes, a kind of ascetic practice of, in the dead of winter, going out naked and grabbing a hold of a marble statue as a way of training ascetically.
Well, so yeah, Diogenes the Cynic would do it nude in cold weather.
Yeah, naked in the snow.
So. But the idea is that he was being a show-off.
Yeah, so. He was being a show-off, exactly.
Mm, that means 50 degrees in this climate. Here.
It's a brisk nude statue hug. It's not really freezing.
Well, I'll tell you, there is a line in our translation that did not come up at all in yours, which gave me this false reading.
Okay.
It says, when you have brought yourself to supply the necessities of your body at a small price, don't pique yourself upon it, nor, if you drink water, be saying upon every occasion, I drink water. But first consider how much more sparing and patient of hardship the poor are than we. That has not even a close to an analog in anything you read.
No, it's not in my translation.
And it makes sense. You know, you think you're a badass ascetic? Well, think of people who actually are starving. Fuck you.
You know those, like, super hardcore metal
ascetics? I fasted. I didn't eat all day. I'm so virtuous.
I didn't eat for 3 days, and I'm seeing blue right now. Oh, yeah?
So I don't know if you guys are familiar with Perseus. It's a server out of Tufts that has a huge collection of original Greek and Roman literature. And then they often have translations cross-referenced with it. So you can go back and forth between the Greek and the English or the Latin or whatever. So they have the translation from George Long, which has that line in it that you just mentioned. Consider how much more frugal the poor are than we and how much more enduring of labor.
So this was originally in Greek and not in Latin, even though we're in Rome?
It's all in Koine Greek.
Okay.
So the same Greek as the New Testament. In fact, this book and the New Testament are where we get Koine Greek. That's where we know what it looks like. Common Greek.
Common Greek is distinguished from what other kind of Greek?
Common Greek just meaning the term koine. Koine just means common. So everyday Greek language. And it's different.
Versus ancient Greek.
Versus Attic Greek. Yeah.
Attic Greek. Okay.
Yeah. And you would contrast that further with Homeric Greek. But it's significantly simpler the way in which most languages, the further you go back, the more cases there are and the more complicated they are.
It didn't make it any easier to translate, apparently.
Apparently not.
Well, I did like the fact that we have a callback here to Augustine and this water fetish. Take a little, spurt it out and tell nobody.
That's like a Sicilian message. Spurt out the water, tell no one. What the hell? It's creepy.
The virtue of not drinking water. It's not part of their health regimen to drink 5 glasses a day or whatever the thing you're supposed to do.
Well, I think it was just saying you're just drinking water and not wine, right?
Well, no, at the end of this is another ascetic practice of you're very thirsty and you take some cold water in your mouth and then you spit it out because you're going to be a tough badass and be really excited. But here he's saying, do that. Go ahead. Be a tough badass, but don't tell anybody. Don't gloat over it like Diogenes and his show-offishness of hugging statues in Greek winter.
Speaking of number 41... It is a mark of want of genius to spend much time in things relating to the body, as to be long in our exercises in eating and drinking and in the discharge of other animal functions. These should be done incidentally and slightly, and our whole attention be engaged in the care of our understanding. So I just want to put that out there because it's most of what we've said here. Again, it's a warrior's thing. You could use this as a discipline if you're a gymnast or something. But no, really, you shouldn't be paying that much attention. This sounds straight up more Plato, pay attention to reason and your ruling faculty. And if you're wasting too much time in the gym, that's not just a matter of disciplining yourself. That's being self-indulgent.
Is it a translation thing? Because what he says, it's a want of genius. And I didn't quite know what that meant. It was a weird word to use in that, you know, you're going to want to be a genius and eat a lot and drink a lot of beer.
It is a surfeit of blockheadedness to spend too much time doing this.
Which section is this again?
41. You going to read us the right translation?
No, I just wanted to make sure I was...
Well, I do want to see you. What does he say instead of want of genius?
He doesn't say genius. He says, it shows lack of refinement to spend a lot of time exercising, eating, drinking, defecating, or copulating. Tending to the body's needs should be done incidentally, as it were. The mind and its functions require the bulk of our attention.
Well, so I believe this translation that we've been using off the Internet Archive is like from the 1700s.
The Carter?
Yes.
There is a revision of the Carter translation, actually, that came out in 2008.
This has to be, because this is not 18th century language. It doesn't sound like it.
It sounds like the fact that it says other bodily functions instead of actually saying copulating and defecating.
Yeah.
That's somebody trying to be more discreet in their translation.
Yes.
So, like, you know what we're talking about. Let's not print it. You're going to be copulating and defecating. We don't have to say it in public. That's not proper.
I thought that would have been Victorian. I was going to say prior to that, just a little bit earlier, and they were much more open about talking about this stuff. That's a Victorian thing.
Well, again, how to be a good spouse is treat your copulation slightly, get it over with.
Incidentally.
Quick and light of touch. That's all. She will be so happy, but if she goes away,
Well, just remember, she's allowed to feel the same way about you.
Just two light touches.
So we might as well say, obviously, this is aimed at men. It was by men. There's one thing in here.
Oh, God.
Number 40. Women from 14 years old are flattered with the title of mistresses by the men. Therefore, perceiving that they are regarded only as qualified to give the men pleasure, they begin to adorn themselves, and in that to place ill their hopes. We should therefore fix our attention on making them sensible that they are valued for the appearance of decent, modest, and discreet behavior.
Shouldn't we stop screwing them at 14 first? That might help.
I thought halfway through that was going in a much more progressive direction.
Well, my translation did, I thought.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, what does yours one say?
Well, because the translation uses self-respect at the end. It says, at the age of 14, girls begin to be addressed by men as ladies. From this, they infer that the world honors them for nothing so much as their potential as sexual partners. Consequently, they become preoccupied with their appearance to the exclusion of everything else. They must be made to realize that they are entitled to be called ladies insofar as they cultivate modesty and self-respect. So it seemed to me that I read this as being surprisingly progressive,
mm-hmm.
in that the reason that it's bad for girls to be cultivated in this way and that it's their environment that makes them care about their appearance to the exclusion of everything else. And in fact, what we should be doing is helping them cultivate modesty and self-respect, both of which are Stoic virtues. So,
yeah, we should be helping them to cultivate all the Stoic virtues and not just those two.
Yes.
That's how that should have ended.
By the way, I've looked over the ancient Greek here, and I don't see anything about the poor. I mean, not that my Greek is stellar, but it matches up with my translation very well, and there's nothing about the poor.
You want to give us a couple lines so we can hear what Koine Greek sounds like?
Όταν εντελέως χρέος σμένος εις κατά το σώμα, that's the body, σώμα, με καλαπίζου επί τούτο μεδ αν ούδαρ, χούδαρ, that's water, πίνες, I think ούδαρ is water, right? Εκ πάσες απορέμες λέγε, that's where you don't say that you drink water. Hoti that uchudar pines, that you drink water all the time. Anyway, so on and so forth. I see it match up with my translation. I don't see where the poor thing comes from. That's baffling.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time that a translator stuck sentences into things to make them more aligned with what they wanted it to say.
That is true. But it just points out what a fraud we all are for not both reading and having this conversation in ancient in Greek.
That would help our listenership greatly.
So should we start over in Greek?
Let's do nonsense Greek. Since 99% of the audience won't know the difference, why not?
Let's just read a diner menu and hope no one notices.
Seems like that would be violating Stoic recommendations to spend so much time laboring over something that is not that useful, this ancient Greek. It almost is like in number 49.
I like the way the word for water, though, sounds so similar. Hodor.
Hodor. 49, this is a smack at the philosophers. When anyone shows himself overly confident in ability to understand and interpret the works of Chrysippus, say to yourself, unless Chrysippus had written obscurely, this person would have no subject for his vanity. But what do I desire? To understand nature and follow her. I ask then who interprets her. And finding Chrysippus does, I have recourse to him. I don't understand his writings. I seek therefore one to interpret them. So far, there is nothing to value myself on. And when I find an interpreter, what remains is to make use of his instructions. This alone is a valuable thing. But if I admire nothing except merely in the interpretation, what if I become more than a grammarian instead of a philosopher? Except indeed that instead of Homer, I interpret Chrysippus. When anyone therefore desires me to read Chrysippus to him, I rather blush when I cannot show my actions agreeable and consonant to his discourse.
That always makes me blush.
There's a lot here and the next section is also about actions instead of words. There are a few of these. I think Seth read one of them earlier, where the idea of being a philosopher, it's about the way you live life. Strangely enough.
Yeah, that got lost somewhere.
Yeah, so we haven't said much about, just to put this a little in the historical context, that Chrysippus is an ancient Greek Stoic, and the Stoics were not concerned just with ethics, that they were also, like when I read the thing, the Wikipedia entry on Chrysippus, it talks about how he created elements of modern logic, things that didn't resurface until Bertrand Russell in that era, Frege, as opposed to Aristotle's, who was a little more simpler logic, and there's stuff about physics in there. So I think it's one of those things where until Epictetus, Stoicism didn't become sort of crystallized as, oh, this thing that's about, what is the image about the being in the flow of the water or the stone, or do you know what I'm talking about?
Really?
I thought there was an image associated with, no, there's not.
Oh.
But I'm trying to, like, the cliche of Stoicism is that you're bending like a reed in the wind. One of those kind of things.
Okay.
Is that from Crouching Tiger?
That's probably from Taoism. It's not until you get to Epictetus that you get it. The ethics distilled like this. And this is the text that like Montaigne had a copy. And so we did Montaigne and already reflected on how he was channeling some of the ancient skeptics like we read in Sextus. And equally, you can take him as channeling Epictetus.
And this would and have likewise, been part of anyone's education at the time, including Shakespeare. I did a little looking around on that, and there's books have been written on the influence of the Stoics on Shakespeare. And so
is it the Stoics in general, or is it Epictetus and the people following him like Marcus Aurelius and Lucretius that even wrote poems and, you know, were just expressing this Stoic attitude of being a Stoic?
I don't know, but I think from what I read, the Enchiridion would have been widely read as part of your education. I'm sure the later Stoics were as well, but early, I don't know how much we have of the earlier Stoics.
I feel like when I was reading some of the background that we don't have very much at all. In fact, maybe none of Chrysippus. And so there's been a lot of work done to see whether Epictetus was being faithful or was a departure, but mostly on the discourses, which are much more detailed and have many, many more references to Chrysippus in it.
Well, Alex, I know you guys did a Chrysippus episode. How did you research that? You just looked at Wikipedia or?
Pretty much.
Okay.
I did what I could. I did my usual, I'm on my lunch break and I'm like, I gotta get this to them. And
who,
Chrysippus.
Who was the guest?
I don't remember. I want to say
Dawn Lubbe,
and she had a weird story about her involvement with Joe Franklin, which was, they weren't like dating or anything, but they used to like hang out and he used to hold her face and say, repeat after me, daddy's going to take care of you. It was the creepiest thing I've ever heard in my life. Even creepier than things that are in this text about not caring about your, far creepier, the Joe Franklin head in the hands, daddy's going to, ugh.
By the way, Joe Franklin is a reference for like 20% of our audience, maybe 15.
Yeah.
People will have to go to the Modern Day Philosophers podcast and hear the final episode with Joe Franklin before he died and this other one on Chrysippus.
Yeah, so you hear his last poignant thoughts and then all the creepy shit he did. So it's like a nice epilogue. Oh, that's sweet. Ew.
Have you done an episode with Cosby?
I think he's got some free time, hasn't he?
I tried. He gave me a drink, and I don't remember what happened after that. So,
well, you bring up Cosby. That's a conversation killer right there.
Yep.
I know. Sorry.
Not a Stoic.
Well, speaking of, what was this thing about? There's a lot of stuff about that you shouldn't put too much energy into your reputation or raising yourself politically, but putting it straight in terms of economic terms, that if you're not the first at entertainments, if you're not invited to the homes of the rich and famous, think about what you would have to give up. That it's just like any activity, that when you take on something, you're taking all the shit that goes with it. You're taking on the challenges. If you decide you're going to be a gymnast, you're committing to a hell of a lot of exercise and self-discipline and all that. And likewise, if you commit yourself to being liked or being a famous person, then you're committing yourself to go and suck up to all these people. Mm-hmm. So if you want to commit yourself to having Bill Cosby come on your show, you're committing yourself to being nice to Bill Cosby and not calling him a dirty old bastard or whatever on your show, you know, because that would be the precondition.
Yeah.
There's always a price. If we're going to go pitch for the great courses, we have to listen to their stuff and we have to like it.
We have to sleep on Casper's beds.
We have to. That's a small price.
Well, that's actually one of the points at which he's driving at the idea that there's fittedness, you know, different types of fittedness for different people. And he's saying basically, if you complain, you know, that you're not invited to dinner at this rich guy's house, but you aren't willing to put in the time sucking up and stroking his ego and, you know, hanging around and doing favors for his daughter or, you know, whatever, then don't complain. If you're not willing to pay the price, then shut up.
And also think that not paying the price is maybe okay because you've maintained your freedom, right? Both of them go hand in hand, that you might even be right for not wanting to do it.
Yeah.
So we mentioned in our recent economics episode that this was a major influence for Adam Smith, which is peculiar given Smith's focus on the foundation of morality being sympathy, whereas this does not seem to be recommending sympathy as the foundation for morality at all. But you do see in here, you know, whether it's in Smith or just in sort of the economic viewpoint in general, this idea of if you take something, you take all the crap that goes with it. This fundamental, I remember this even straight out of Ayn Rand, that if you will something, you will the means to that thing. Maybe this is straight from Aristotle. I should give it to him instead. But that's part of what being rational is. You can't will something without willing everything that goes with it, without willing the means to get to that thing.
Yeah. And then you can't complain when you don't get it because you didn't put in any work.
Yeah. Or when you get those things that you should have expected to come with it, because that's part of the deal, right? This thing about are you going to put in the time sucking up, or are you going to forego this favor? He says something in here about, don't think you can get something for nothing. This is part of the way of nature, right? That there's a cost. I don't know. What do you think about that? The whole nature as economical in some way.
I think it's all part of this strategy that he's suggesting for how to deal with things, is that he's trying to make an association between your desire and then also what's in your control, or at least part of what's in your control, and saying that not only is there an issue with having desire for something that you have no control over, which you may or may not receive or may not get or may not experience, but also if you have desires for things that require hard work. So there's a section where he talks about being an athlete. Maybe this is in the discourses. I don't remember.
No, it's in here. Yep.
About being an Olympic athlete. And he says, you want to go compete in the Olympics, but you don't want to train every day and you don't want to eat and deprive your body of all these pleasures. Don't complain. Like, if you want to be an Olympic athlete, then there's a huge commitment that you have to make. And he's making a point about desires. And I think I can speculate that he's addressing people in the society who are complaining about not getting things that they haven't done anything to achieve or deserve, and this kind of, we see it now today, there's this entitlement culture that seems to be emerging after several generations of helicopter parents, right? And so the question is, anytime somebody says, I didn't get this or I deserve that, and say, well, what did you do to deserve it? What did you do to get it? That seems perfectly reasonable. Again, great tactical strategy. Not sure about the broader teleology.
Yeah, so that's the thing about the athletics is in 29. So dipping down a little after that, he talks about the things you have to do to be an athlete, and also about going to war, all the things you have to do to train yourself. Then in combat, you may be thrown into a ditch, dislocate your arm, turn your ankle, swallow dust, be whipped, and after all, lose the victory. When you have evaluated all this, if your inclination still holds, then go to war. Otherwise, take notice. You will behave like children who sometimes play like wrestlers, sometimes gladiators, sometimes blow a trumpet, and sometimes act a tragedy when they have seen and admired these shows. Thus you too will be at one time a wrestler, at another a gladiator, now a philosopher, then an orator, but with your whole soul, nothing at all. Like an ape, you mimic all you see, and one thing after another is sure to please you, but is out of favor as soon as it becomes familiar. For you have never entered upon anything considerately, nor after having viewed the whole matter on all sides, or made any scrutiny into it, but rashly and with a cold inclination. Grow the fuck up. That's this is saying.
What children play tragedy?
We have to remember that this is all the TV they had.
You certainly would have been doing it in ancient Greece, right?
Mommy, can I watch tragedy? Too. No, not tonight.
Tragedy's too violent. We had this discussion.
I think they more likely would have been playing war. They would have had a lot of firsthand experience with it, I would imagine.
Well, they sent their people to fight the Trojans over there instead of letting the Trojans come here. That was a Iraq/Trojan war.
They didn't really have the horse like they said. We were lied to. And
they had no horses of mass destruction.
Yeah, there it is.
All right. Any sort of last, how has this affected your life? Is this just unworkable enough that, like, I was brought to mind immediately. We haven't brought this up yet, so let me throw it out here. But the modern version of this, the serenity prayer. Oh, God, give us the serenity to accept what cannot be changed, the courage to change what cannot be changed, the courage to change what can be changed, and the wisdom to know the difference. It's another one from the other. So that's from Reinhold Niebuhr, who's in this century, in the 20th century.
Yes, and what did Reinhold Niebuhr experience? Where did he get that insight?
Well, clearly it's through Augustine, I think, that Stoicism had a big impact on Christianity.
This is the kind of thing that floats around and people use it as an inspirational saying. And I think what's great about inspirational sayings is that you don't try to live by them consistently. You bring them to bear when they're helpful. So when you are faced by a tragedy or something that's out of your control, then you can say, look, I just got to remember that this is not under my control and I got to just chill out. Not that I have to say, I don't care about my child who's in mortal danger. And then I have to prepare myself and whisper in his ear that he's going to die.
Even though that's totally metal.
But these are helpful therapeutically, helpful as rules of thumb. But I think should not be taken seriously as a guide to life. I don't like what Stoicism, what Epictetus would be commanding you to actually do with your brain in order to not care about your kids in that way. And I know we've had some differences in terms of, you could give a softer interpretation of Epictetus where you don't end up being an asshole, where you could actually be a good father and a good family member. And maybe Epictetus himself was those things. And so we need to read this charitably, but sort of taking example after example at face value, I find it very hard to think that this is something that should be seriously pursued.
The main thing that I would get out of this is just try to keep perspective as much as you can, which is, I think, very helpful, like that serenity prayer thing we were mentioning. But I think if you really stuck to all these, you had something wrong with you to begin. I don't think this is actually able to be done without you being crazy.
So I think we're entitled to pick and choose and to appreciate some of the fundamental insights in this without saying we have to live by the book, and that's absurd. So for instance, I thought, again, I think there's a thing that's important. I think it's only implied, but this, what I call the difference between two different kinds of suffering. One of the deprivation itself, or the loss, I lose someone or I don't get something I want. And then the deprivations that are particularly human that come on top of that, like envy, for instance, or deprivations that depend on your expectation of what the world owes you or what's right or just or what's fair or not unfair. That sort of suffering, I think it's insightful to say that by attending to our judgments about things and our cultivating a certain kind of reflectiveness or even a mindfulness, that we can modulate that sort of suffering.
I'm basically on Wes on the picking and choosing side of this, maybe because I'm basically a pragmatist, but I don't worry at all about the extreme versions of it. Maybe it's because in Seth's words that I'm taking it more tactical than overarching. I find a lot of it, even if it's more about a way or a disposition of a large variety of things, I just find myself deeply sympathetic to it.
Hmm. As I mentioned, when I wore a younger man's clothes, this is...
this. Are you going to sing us a song?
Yeah.
Yes, sounds I'm like a piano man.
Guitar should be strumming at this point.
Well, no, this is the kind of thing that I was more attracted to. And as I've grown older and been more exposed to and more influenced by philosophies and philosophical ideas of connecting with people, and that being the basis of ethics, I'm less sympathetic. I'm on the one hand drawn to the idea of flourishing and distinguishing that from what I'll call mere happiness. And that's something that I see partially in, like we've been talking about Buddhism, but also just recently I came across Viktor Frankl again, talking about the difference between meaning and happiness in one's life. I saw that paralleled here to some extent, but I'm always suspicious of teleology, particularly when it's connected with social station. And I do just get a vibe. I love a lot of the things he says as strategies for dealing with life's disappointments and with the obstacles that life will place in your way. But it also strikes me as the voice of somebody who has had so many of those things that he had to come up with a way of dealing with them and is now generalizing and exporting that as a way for all people to live their lives, I think is questionable. I had one other little thread about the things you can control versus the things you can't control, there being a tension between a certain kind of freedom and a certain kind of determinism that I think is interesting because based on reading Eva's book and talking about Augustine and the notion of kind of inventing the will, that he doesn't have that conceptual thing available to him. But I'll just drop that for the listeners to follow up on. I would also encourage people, there's a very nice entry in the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy about Epictetus that gives a lot of context and good explication. So if you're looking to round things out, that's a good resource.
All right. Well, unfortunately, the reactions of the audience members to this episode is outside of our control, so it is nothing to me. That issue of it seems like you have to be self-contained according to Stoicism, and especially not care what other people think of you, but at the same time, we have to remember that Epictetus don't just use this as an excuse to like be self-contained, and those bastards, they don't understand me. I feel like people use Stoicism in an immature way like that, but that even Epictetus recognizes in all these many things that he tells you about how to act at parties, that what people think of you does depend a lot on how you actually act. And so while he doesn't want you to do disreputable things to gain their favor, being polite and doing things that would endear you to others is fine. As always with these wisdom tradition kind of things, it seems like applying it would require good judgment.
Brings us back to the brain damage philosophers.
There you go. Next time, you probably already heard, we are doing a live podcast in Pittsburgh on Hannah Arendt. So if you want to read the things that we read to prepare for it, go get her book, The Human Condition, and read the first two sections on The Human Condition and the Public and the Private Realm. We are supported by your donations. Please go to partsexaminelife.com to make a contribution, big or small.
Big donors since last time include Jim Wetzel, who, as you may recall, appeared on our Augustine After Show. We contacted him out of the blue. He not only showed up to that, did an awesome job, but then he gives us money on top of it. Very classy. And I recommend, again, that you check down his book, Augustine, A Guide for the Perplexed. Also, William Pontius, Paul Kreider, Stephen Sanchez, Harriet Tempe Yapa, Robinson Kuntz, Jason Lawrence, Craig Jennings, Daniel Ford, Randall Gilliam, Joshua Duke, Nell Iyer, Luca Brennecke, Yuri Dzoba, Michael Pierre, Seema Mahoon, Robert Kempel, Josh Khoury, Eric Risberg, Jeannie Carey, and Justin Lungrich.
Thanks also to the smaller donors, including those who are newly or on a continued basis signed up for our $5 a month citizen site. If you are a citizen like that, you should definitely be subscribed to our citizen feed so that you can get all these episodes unbroken and ad-free beamed straight to your mobile device. If you don't want to do that, you can interact with us in other ways. Go to partsexaminelife.com, subscribe to our blog. We've got an awesome Facebook group. You can follow us on Twitter and support us through our Amazon affiliation, which means that every time you buy anything through Amazon, go to our site first, click on the banner. You don't actually have to do that every time. Just do it once and bookmark that and make that your new Amazon landing page. And then without any additional spending on your part, some of that money will go to us and make us produce many more wonderful podcasts. Even though that's out of my control, I still feel a little concerned about it. Thank you, Alex, for joining us.
Thanks, Alex.
Yeah.
Good luck with your My Racist Toaster and Modern Day Philosophers and other projects.
You. Yes. Yeah, and me and Danny have another podcast starting with CBS called Mostly Bull Market, which is going to be about the same way we do Modern Day Philosophers, just joking about philosophy. It'll be that, but with finance. So that's going to be pretty awesome.
You guys know enough about finance to do?
No, we're going to do it anyway.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Wanna hold you inside out. Wanna see you finish first. Like Delta Gobard Wars. Wanna do cause. Wanna breathe through you. Take my leave through you. But I won't. Something already stronger than you feel alive. Something already pulls from that point your eyes on me. you.